linguistic art chicks.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Well, here we are back together again in less than a week. As I mentioned in the last podcast, I'm taking a little road trip and might not get another podcast out until the end of next week. So this way we won't go over 7 days between our little get-togethers here in the salon. And before I forget it, I want to thank Charlie H. and our regular donor, Dr. Laura, for their donations to help offset the expenses that come up with these podcasts. I really appreciate your help, Charlie and Laura, as well as what many of our fellow saloners are doing in the way of posting their thoughts and comments to our blog and over on the forums at thegrowreport.com. There's a lot of interaction going on in these forums, and I think you'll find them quite interesting if you get a chance to surf over there someday. Well, as you can see from the title of today's podcast, I'm going to be playing one of the talks that was given at the recent psychedelic conference in Basel, Switzerland last week. And thanks to Otto Vidal and his brave little MP3 recorder, many of the talks given in English were captured and placed online. And if you've been surfing the Psychedelic Salon forum over at thegrowreport.com, you've probably already downloaded and listened to some of them. And over the next few months, our friend Max Freakout over on the Cannabis Podcast Network at dopetheme.co.uk is going to be podcasting most of these talks, which he also recorded. So eventually you'll be able to hear them all in podcast format over at Psychonautica. But as I said, if you go over to our forum, you can find the link to download many of them directly right now. Now, getting on with today's talk, we've got a real treat. In fact, this is the one talk from the conference that I've heard the most comments about, and it's by Carolyn Garcia, who is also known as Mountain Girl. And to introduce her properly would actually require several podcasts, and so I'm going to take the quick and easy way out and read a few lines about her that I found on Wikipedia. And while I realize that we can't trust everything we read on Wikipedia, I think that these basic facts are at least in the ballpark of being correct. And here's part of what they have to say. Carolyn Adams Garcia was a merry prankster and the wife of Jerry Garcia. After growing up near Poughkeepsie, New York, Adams met Neil Cassidy in 1964, who introduced her to Kesey and his friends, one of whom gave her the name Mountain Girl. Cassidy took her to La Honda, Ken Kesey's base of operations, where she quickly joined the inner circle of pranksters and was romantically involved with Kesey, having a daughter by him named Sunshine. Before actually marrying in 1981, Jerry Garcia and Adams had two daughters. Garcia and Mountain Girl ultimately divorced in 1994. However, they remained personal friends right up until Garcia's death a few months later. Now, I'm going to warn you ahead of time that this recording isn't all that clear. I've used all of the tools that I have to clean up the sound as best I could, but it's still a recording of a talk given over a loudspeaker system in a large room. However, for a lot of reasons, I want to play it anyway. And should I ever come across a clear recording of Mountain Girl's talk, I'll replace this one that we fortunately have thanks to the good work of Otto Vidal and his brave little MP3 recorder. And in a way, I really like the way this talk sounds because it reminds me of some of the old bootleg recordings I've heard of Dead concerts, which seems very appropriate when you think about it. So now let's join Carolyn Mountain Girl Garcia as she reminisces about the pranksters, the Grateful Dead, and the 60s.
Dieter asked me to write my speech in advance, so I did, and I sent it in 3 weeks ago to be translated for this event. I've never done anything like that before, so these are not my words of today, they are my words of 3 weeks ago. And I will be showing some pictures. In 1964, I was working at Stanford University in my first real job, away from home, I was 17, running the immense mass spectrometer that occupied the basement of the organic chemistry department, analyzing organic compounds from many sources. Although I was very young, at 17 years old, I had a good job, my own apartment, and an independent life. Life seemed very secure and steady. The international graduate students who were working in the laboratory upstairs were having all-night parties amid the terrible smells of their research projects. There was an uneasy edge to these celebrations, not from the vodka, but from other compounds they were biologically assessing. My work environment deteriorated, and I began to lock the door as I worked late into the night. My boss, an urbane Austrian, brought to my attention a certain sample that he wanted me to process quickly for a research fellow working in West Africa. It was an extract of iboga, a plant used in rituals by witch doctors, he said, and was likely a hallucinogenic drug. I was instructed to handle this particular sample with great care. Late one night, as the party upstairs was in full swing, my curiosity about hallucinogens intensified, and I ran the sample, ingesting a small portion of it that spilled by accident. The effect was swift and sent me into a new world of imaginary distortions and a deep, dreamy sleep. Unable to complete the analysis, I shut down the spectrometer and spoiled the results. My boss awakened me in the morning and sent me home. Staggering out into the brilliant sunshine, I had no idea where I was. I couldn't remember where I lived or how I got there. I got on my bicycle to make it look good and began to pedal. My body remembered where to go. If I carefully disengaged my brain, I could make the correct turns. Even though I had no conscious memory of ever having gone there before, somehow I found my way home, across town, over by the freeway. I had dreams of jaguars and pyramids, jungle foliage, birds, and feathery beings. If there were messages, I don't recall. But I did bring back an unwelcome visitor. Powerful auditory hallucinations. For many months afterward, sudden loud voices came straight into my ear, speaking in a language I didn't understand. I had no translator or guide, and no one to talk to about my experience. And there were other changes. The spectrometer became alien and unfriendly. The 14 steps necessary to prepare the machine and insert the sample were now unworkable. My unreliable work performance was now under scrutiny. I had been the star of the lab, but now too confused to perform necessary complex tasks, and so lost my job. After a year of working nights, I began to look for friends and to expand my social life. Stanford University fostered a rich, youthful mix, a frothy stew of artists, writers, new bohemians, and musicians. It was 1964, a golden, easy time, and I fell into a good place. I met a group of people, now my lifelong friends. Intrepid Traveler and the Merry Band of Pranksters had existed for a summer's high adventure, penetrating America on an old bus. I had heard of them as a legendary party gang in the hills near Palo Alto, California. In September, I met Neil Cassidy at the local coffee shop and went exploring with him for a whole night, driving around the mountains, exchanging stories, searching for his friend who had some bennies, and eventually came to Ken Kesey's house in the Redwood Forest, west of Palo Alto. At the first light of morning, we drove down the dark mountain valley road, bumped over a little bridge, and rolled to a silent stop in front of a huge, wildly painted bus. It was glowing in the flaming red light of dawn, the most amazing, wonderful thing I had ever seen. A sign at the top proclaimed the name further. Here was an artwork, a mystery, worked on by many, many hands, with layer upon layer of paintings. Even the wheels were multicolored. A normal school bus is plain yellow with the purpose of safety for children. This bus was not yellow, it is purple, mysterious, with cracked windows and broken, flapping door, but certainly not safe. The paintings were both meticulously detailed and random in an unplanned, playful style. I sensed the ripples of a great mystery. And as I touched the rough paint, I felt the stinging challenge to ordinary ways of seeing and being. Over the door, a little painted sign read, "Nothing lasts." Ken Kesey and his friends had swept me into their circle. I immediately realized that these were the friends I had been looking for. Active, bright, adventuresome characters, full of fun, and strongly linked on many new levels. They embodied a concept of a personal artistic freedom and license, a license they freely gave themselves, and they also had LSD. Ken Kesey impressed everyone with his intelligence, his brilliant writing, and his cascades of ideas. With two prize-winning novels, he was already a celebrity. As a dramatic public speaker, he filled with energy and personality, and possibly multitudes of personalities. He had a lot of extra parts to his mind, and they were not necessarily always working together as one. His book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, was his first writing success, but it was deeply enriched by Kesey's exposure to mescaline, psilocybin, and LSD as a test subject, as a student test subject in a government-sponsored study, and his work as an assistant at the local mental hospital, and he worked nights. He had always had an abiding, intense interest in the plight of schizophrenics and institutionalized people labeled as insane. With his three young children, and his wife Faye, and a series of dachshunds and cats and birds, their simple home was a warm, welcoming, and boisterous place. The enormous, round, rustic table filled one end of the living room and easily seated 15 people or more, and all were welcomed and fed. We were part audience, part family, as Kesey led discussions late into the night. As the children went to bed, the all-night conversation moved out into the Kesey's writing studio, a little cabin by the creek, out past the colorful bus parked outside under the giant redwood trees. Kesey and his friends were practicing transformation. First, transforming their original selves into super personalities for the super drugs they were taking. Developing new personas for mutually supporting transformed states of mind. New characters manifested and evolved and mutated and played together in the circle of trees, illuminated also by the colorful bus and the continuous repainting. Laughter was our sign of success. If it was funny, it was good. Kesey would announce a party. His real one. He loved to create a space and transform it into something that cracked the boundaries of normal time or lived outside of time. And he'd invite people into it to amaze and delight them. Saturday night parties brought the most cross-fertilization from Berkeley to Stanford to San Francisco, and all manner of poets, musicians, and artists, friends and travelers would drive down. Speakers in the high in the trees softly played Miles Davis, John Coltrane. Keezy and the Pranksters had recorded a huge tape like this. And the forest rang with readings by William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg, mixed with music from Beethoven, Ray Charles, Paul Horn, and Bob Dylan. New audio recordings were made at each event with fun feedback and tape looped lag. Movie cameras captured the peak moments from replay at the next event as part of the time bending exercise. Keezy was obsessed with recording all events, and I was pressed into editing and creating short pieces of film. 75 hours of film in cans was stacked inside the studio, shot during the Pranksters' earlier bus trip to New York earlier that summer. I missed that bus trip, but I met them shortly after they returned. The boxes of tapes and shelves were spilling out all these recordings, and it needed attention, labeling and cataloging. And further itself was wired for sound with stereo headphones, which you can see in this picture hanging behind Neil Cassidy's head. My stereo headphones and microphones for communications between crew, driver, and anyone riding on top of the bus. Of course, this stuff only works some of the time. An Ampex stereo tape deck wired to a mixing panel created feedback loops, echoes, and we broadcast from speakers on the roof deck as we rolled along, tootling on flutes, whistles, and horns, singing and commenting on everything as we passed. Driver Neil Cassidy kept up a deep philosophical conversation with all of us at the once when everything was working. With a great deal of masking tape, electrician's tape, recording tape, wire, solder, film, with a noisy generator and a wavering electric current, we somehow made it all work. Technical complexity, bus breakdowns, and crew instability always threatened to upset the plan of the hour. Managing to get all this working while tripping on the excellent stand-up LSD was the further challenge. Keezy steered our vessel with the guidance of the chain. He often threw his coins daily, frequently giving each line, the throw for each line to a different person. They recorded both questions and readings in a big book. The judgment of the I Ching was often correct, in depth, and set new directions. It gave very clear advice. We depended on it for clarifications and community-building insights. There was also an ever-changing crew, as people came for a few journeys and left again. In the summer of 1965, the gatherings intensified, drawing in visitors to weekend-long explorations, bringing in new players and challenges from police. Owsley Stanley came with his retinue and shared his products and his ideas for future events. We attracted writers, Ginsberg, Hunter Thompson, Robert Stone, and biker poet Freewheeling Franklin brought the entire Oakland Hells Angels Motorcycle Club for a 3-day campout as the police watched from the road. Every expedition to San Francisco on the further bus attracted new people back to home base, eager to continue their exploration with psychedelics and the Pranksters. Yet the events continued, growing larger and longer, until Keezy finally realized that chaos, while not exactly the enemy, was overwhelming his home in the forest. Evolution dictated change. And we moved the events over the hill and into the city. In about 1965, in November, the first acid test blossomed very briefly at a private house in San Jose, California. Whispered word to a few people. The information spread, and the right audience appeared. They appeared with an air of secret vision. And we couldn't advertise ahead of time, or too many might come. We put up elaborate hand-drawn posters at bookstores. We put up wonderful hand-drawn posters at bookstores and coffee houses that we knew were good places where people we knew would congregate. And they had no location written on them. And we would fill in that information at the very last minute, and possibly just by word of mouth. We manifested about a dozen of these events altogether as 1965 rolled over into 1966. The acid test succeeded as a format for all-night events. Music, lights, costumes, dancers, toys, spontaneous and raw, lasting until dawn spread its peace. The Big Beat Lounge in Palo Alto, the Near Beach Community Center, Fillmore Auditorium in Portland, Oregon, all boomed with the Prankster Orchestra sound collage, which was really ahead of its time. You'd like it better now. And the rhythm and groove sound of the Pro-Agette. We also had escalating legal problems. Keezy, of course, was the target of law enforcement. They were determined to imprison him. And as a drug ringleader. And his resistance demanded a lot of time and money and personal energy. And in January of 1966, we were fully mobilized. And in collaboration with a wonderful group of artists in San Francisco, we spent 3 days working at the Trips Festival. The first event of its kind, it brought together rock and roll musicians, poets, early liquid light shows, experimental movies, projections, mystics, and an array of gadgetry and artists and trippers, even offering places to plug in for people bringing their own gadgets to the event. We were all inside the giant pinball machine together. Audience participation was very high, and our inner cyclotrons were fully charged with the excitement of everything happening at once. Howling chaos and jubilant participation ruled for 3 nights that changed the perception of what life could be for all who were there. And there's an excellent film that's been made about the Trips Festival recently by my friend Eric Christensen. It's a short documentary, about an hour long, and then he included a panel discussion also that has some of the organizers of the Trips Festival, and you should be able to find a source for that online. It's just simply called the Trips Festival. It's a very good documentary. It's quite new. So our Prankster crew worked hard at the Trips Festival despite an unfortunate encounter with the San Francisco police the night before. We were arrested on a rooftop and spent a couple days in jail just before the Trips Festival. And after the Trips Festival, disruption overtook us. Keezy was obviously going to go to jail this time, and he decided to leave the country to avoid prosecution. Leaving the bus and the Pranksters and his family behind to sort out all the details, he faked his own suicide and then fled to Mexico with Ron Boise, an infamous sculptor who knew the backcountry roads. Further, and our Prankster crew kept going on. we went forward. We didn't know what else to do. Without Kizzy, it felt rudderless and sort of anxious, and we just decided to follow the route we had laid out for ourselves and continue to perform acid tests. Despite the immense wave of bad publicity and surrounding Kizzy's arrest and his disappearance out in the world, we were pretty notorious. And we began to host acid tests in the Los Angeles area. It seemed too dangerous to return to the San Francisco area for quite a while. And winter in warm Southern California was very appealing. Even without Kizzy's inspirational guidance, the acid tests were so much fun. We kept doing them wherever we could find a safe place. And this card is what we carry. And this is our card. And this is how the back of the card looks. I still have mine. Sunset Strip, Pico Boulevard, Hollywood, Hollywood and Vine, La Jolla, San Juan Capistrano, Asilomar, and Laurel Canyon became our new locales. We had no money. Very little money. They became adept dumpster divers just to stay alive. We charged $1 or $2 for admission to our events, which barely covered the expense. And here's a poster from one of those events. You can see that it's pretty old now. We shared space with a group of new friends. Hugh Romney, who became waiting greatly at Woodstock years later, and his beautiful wife, Miss Bonnie Jean, Tiny Tim, Del Close, and other performers from the Second City and the Phantom Circus joined us. Our brave band of friendly musicians who had followed us down from Palo Alto to be at our event would set up and play. They enjoyed the chaos and the free form of our first event. And they didn't care how crazy things got. They were reliable and game to come play with us. They dragged their equipment into whatever tiny space we had for them, plugged in, and worked with us with the blown fuses. The broken microphones, the tape running out on the floor, wires writhing everywhere, and goofy altered people running through it all. They persisted, and they played. Sometimes they were a bit too far gone to play, and would just begin a few notes and stop. In amazement at the chaos, however, they were ready for this, and easily entertained themselves. Our friendship grew strong and solid. They were Pigpen, Phil Lesh, Jerry Garcia, Bob Weir, and Bill Kreutzmann of the Grateful Dead. We had meetings to try to organize these events ahead of time, but I was so busy running the sound system and the equipment and loading tape and soldering microphones. There's the original Warlocks, which became the Grateful Dead, set up at an acid test in Los Angeles. And they would play when they could. I was so busy running everything, and I just had to limit myself to a very small dose, to a very small working LSD dose, around 75 to 100 micrograms. And tuning into the cosmic was enough to keep me aware of everything on all levels around me, but responsibly functional as well all night long. I also needed to have enough energy to be able to help load up the bus in the morning. So I never really got all that high at an acid test. I never melted down. I was working. I had a serious mission. I wish I could have gone with the flow, but it just wasn't available to me. You know, focus was far too important to carry the events forward. And without focus, it pretty much would have fallen apart. We recorded and filmed as much as we could afford to. Some of this material still exists and is available at Keeley.com, but it is pretty fragmented. You know, I look back on it now, and I have to ask myself, what were we doing? We were short-sighted. We had no plan about where we were going or what we would do, or how we were going to put gas on the bus. We charged about $1, sometimes $2 to get in. And if you had a good costume, you probably could get in for free. Folks did dress up. Costuming was easy in L.A. And stuff was the great place for costumes. And I remember we were drawing plenty of new people in. And we were deliberately eliminating... I'm going to go back. We were deliberately eliminating the audience-performer boundary and inspiring free expression and open participation. We encouraged it. It was the only thing that kept it going. The audience became the show. We had pots of fluorescent paint in day-glow colors under powerful black lights for people to paint themselves and transform their body. A brilliant strobe light that I liberated from Stanford Research Institute pulsed at the far end of our spaceship. It had a huge dial with flash intervals of up to 1,000 per second, and we could reset the beat to any level. We rigged lights and screens for liquid projections, and we mixed this with film and slides and primitive color wheels and sheets of mylar that you would hold up and wave around. All projected onto the whole room. We didn't use screens. We just projected onto the whole room whatever we had. And onto people's faces and bodies and the floor, the bus, anywhere, anything that we could project onto. Stuart Brand, who was the main organizer of the TRIPS Festival, joined our crew for the Los Angeles acid test. And he had a stack of slide projectors filled with images of Native Americans mixed up with film loops of old bus trips and more of these wobbly mylar reflections. Our patched together sound system linked it all together with rotating feedback loops, which I wish I had one to, we could play with it here, you'd like it. And pre-recorded music samples mixed in with whatever sounds the open microphones took in. We had open microphones out on the floor so people could extemporize or wail or scream as the energy moved them. The musicians jumped in at intervals, or whenever the cure broke, as it always did. They would perform sporadically and heroically as the spirit moved them amid the spinning lights and the pulsating dancers in a completely altered reality. A basket of hand instruments, bells, and whistles was there for us all. We spoke cryptic and poetic over the sound system. We tried to keep the energy inside the building in balance or even in a rhythm so that there were rests and peaceful, quiet parts. We organized one of our final acid tests in the city of Watts, which is a ghost town suburb of Los Angeles, where terrible economic riots and race riots had burned buildings and destroyed neighborhoods only 4 months before. There were empty streets and abandoned stores and homes, and it seemed like a fine place for an outsider's event. Prankster Malfunction rented an empty brake repair shop right on Watts Main Street. And we hung a few posters in bookstores and any weren't busy. By now, we were attracted a repeat audience. We were seeing the same people week after week. We knew we were in a kind of a danger zone. And we took caution to stage the event far away from normal white affluent entertainment areas of the city. The room was large, reasonably clean, and had adequate power. And as we loaded our equipment into the building, it seemed almost too large. It was a little bigger than this room. We enclosed our central space with wires and sound gear, but there was no comfort. Just hard concrete floors and walls. As the crowd came in and filled up the voice, the room warmed up and seemed safe. About an hour later, it became obvious that there was too much medicine in the Kool-Aid. After a quick recalculation, the only answer we found was to give out smaller cups and put a lot more Kool-Aid was added in to dilute the mix. Many people ended up on the floor in oblivion, and some were in distress. Yet the music was playing, the night was peaceful, and the ending was very loving. And as people came back to themselves, they smiled as they left and walked out into the sunrise. Two police officers looked in on us as we poured the leftover Kool-Aid drink down the storm drain outside. They thought we were crazy drunks. They were well rid of us. They did arrest a few pranksters who were very high flyers that night, which kept the police busy as everyone else packed up and left. These sacrifices were soon back among us, but the police didn't want them after all. And we learned something about grace from these events. A kind of peaceful glow emerged as people re-entered their normal time and drifted back to their lives. Sharing so closely with total strangers, sharing playful, intimate, and deep moments, and even if we never spoke, we all knew. We knew that it was right, necessary, and productive. Also revolutionary and radical in the importance of the experiences of that time, when our society was so at odds with itself. We also felt the intensifying hot breath of police interest. Well, the magical substance itself was so rare and precious, the jewel that opened the doors. The unifying experience of the acid test was needed to bring along as many people as we could during a very short window of time. And so, in early 1966, LSD was made, at some point, was made illegal to disaster use. And what was left of the Mary Prankster crew, minus Kiwi, decided in a panic to make a run for the relative safety of Mexico. And we all got on the bus in Los Angeles in the middle of the night, fearing imminent arrest. Seriously, it was scary. We were being followed. And we, you know, you could just feel it, a pressure, feel it on the back of your neck. And we drove all night long through the desert on the back roads, going to the smallest town we could find, a tiny, tiny town to cross the border. The many pranksters who were left behind were angry and self-abandoned. The truth was, there was little room left on the bus, and we had 12 people that went with us, with almost no money and all the gear. I felt very crowded and hot. Everything we had was used up in the acid tests. We were a hungry, raggedy, colorful lot as we unloaded everything off the bus for the two Mexican border guards, who finally were satisfied that our beat-up gear contained nothing of interest and let us pass. And we drove on south for days and days. Further was heavily loaded and very slow. And the gas was of terrible quality, and with failing brakes and vapor lock and bad clutch, and first the throttle linkage brought up a long mountain hill, and we had to push the bus up the hill. And then the firewall caught on fire when the battery cable shorted out enough that kept us somewhere for a long time. Delay and delay. Everywhere we went, the adults would cross themselves and look away quickly. Oh, loco. And their little children would cheer and jump up and down and wave. I was 8 months pregnant and very uncomfortable. 19 years old, and unable to focus on what was happening to me. We were very, very tired. I cried for days as we pushed on in the heat. America receded. With all its politics, we don't have hope. Courtrooms, unpleasant attitudes, and unconscious, poorly managed wealth, wars, attitudes, and advertising. Mexico began to feel relaxed, humble, and genuine. Our one thought was to find Kiwi and go somewhere safe, and inexpensive, and remote, and pleasant. We were so stressed and strained about what had happened that we began to fight among ourselves. We didn't have individual money. We had a can with money in it. If somebody got money, the money went into the can, and we took out individually what we needed. Often money would be there one night and be gone the next morning. Finally, near Mazatlan, we caught up with Katie, who had gone before us, fleeing from prosecution after the Trips Festival. We caught up with him and blew his cover completely. He was disguised as a mild-mannered ornithologist doing bird research in the jungle. But he was crazy and paranoid and imagined a federal agent behind every cactus and was so very upset with us and refused to get aboard the bus. So further, after much discussion, further drove on south to Manzanillo, which at that time was a sleepy little resort town on a beautiful Pacific beach. The depleted pranksters holed up in an old compound that would rest on the beach. We found some hammocks, and we survived. And the Kiwi family all joined us later. 6 months later, and it was time to return to the U.S. Believing that things had died down, even with all the acid tests behind us, having shattered the possibility to be normal, responsible citizens in the U.S., but we still had to go back. Further, we drove further through Texas and we crossed the border without incident. And Kiwi rejoined us a few miles up the road, disguised as a country western musician with a drinking problem. And back we went to California on the bus, and some of us were really sick by now. So, and we headed to San Francisco, to San Francisco State College, where there was a Grateful Dead show. Kiwi, unfortunately, was inspired to do an interview broadcast on the college radio station and made rude remarks about the FBI director, saying that his return to the U.S. was to rub salt in J. Edgar Hoover's wounds. Alert and angry, the FBI agents arrested him a few days later. The pranksters were exhausted with no money. We really had no center or mission. Our mission was completed, and we had no place to be together. Keithy's family drove further to Oregon to start a new home in a dairy farm near their family. And that's the Keithy home outside Eugene, Oregon. And getting off the bus was the next problem. Once the bus had gone to Oregon, I was off the bus too, so luckily my brother was living in San Francisco, and I stayed with him for a few weeks, adjusting to a solo existence, motherhood, and a stationary life, and discovered where the Grateful Dead lived, over on Ashbury Street, and had an emotional reunion with those dear friends. I soon moved in with Jerry Garcia as our affection blossomed, and I plunged into living in a wonderful old Victorian house with a 9 men, some sleeping on chairs because there were no beds. So at age 20, with a baby in my arms and Haight Street just 2 blocks away, I began cooking for the Great Dead crew. cooking what I was calling the brown rice and burned pork chops diet. We ate communally, and we pooled the money. The musicians each got about $50 a week in allowance from Danny Rifkin, our manager. I was beginning again in a relationship that would last nearly 30 years. Jerry was charming and talented, in the center of a strong, committed enterprise. The Haight-Ashbury's budding alternative community of artists. So the Haight-Ashbury was just blooming right at that moment in late 66. The community of artists and shopkeepers and artists and musicians, and it was at that just beginning to crest moment. Everybody knew each other. And when summer came, so did everyone else. The media had spread an image of San Francisco that spring that one could go to the Haight-Ashbury and a magic would unfold in your lap. Or maybe John Lennon would show up. The community in the Haight-Ashbury was completely overwhelmed in very short order by thousands of wanderers from all over America who similarly had nothing but expectations and were sleeping on the sidewalks, sleeping in the park, had no money and no food. So very young people came to San Francisco and had to fend for themselves. It was a shock to see all those waves of homeless kids with their little puppies and sad faces with no safe place to be. And as they began to experiment with various psychedelics and other drugs, the streets became ever more unsafe. 1967 was both charming and pathetic on Haight Street, and new heroes emerged. The caring people in the neighborhood were now organizing to care for and feed them, to find them places to stay, to get in legal representation for the many arrests. I felt very fortunate to live in a house with a caring man who loved me, a safe place to be as the chaos rose around us like an angry ocean. The mayor declared war on the unruly streets. As media crews prowled the parks looking for stories, the police arrested hundreds and the smell of tear gas blew up into the hills. The alternative community responded with free food programs in the park, a free clinic, free stores, free boxes. We called for meetings at our house to plan benefits and free concerts, trying to create a better vibe, to manifest a kinder world. Organizers came in from the free speech movement, the civil rights groups, and the anti-war groups. And jubilation resurfaced as an ideal. Oh, jubilation resurfaced as an ideal. In other words, we put that out there. Let's celebrate. And we celebrated with parades and free concerts without permits to the dismay of the civic elders. Without police, music drew thousands out to the parks and out to the green grass. The Grateful Dead was part of a community of local music hyped as the San Francisco Sound. Big Brother and the Holding Company, Jefferson Airplane, the Quicksilver Messenger Service, and all had roots in earlier Bay Area folk music scene, and they all knew each other. And the musicians would freely exchange songs and stage shows and play with each other. It was really a lot of fun. It was so easy to cooperate as tribal units, we discovered, and to put together last-minute plans for events. Energy and enthusiasm for what we could throw together in the face of serious police action buoyed the whole community. Communes, group living, free newspapers, and a sense of vital connection and social evolution welded the chaos into common purpose. Free expression, free experimentation, free will. Sparks flew in all directions. As we already know, nothing lasts. The Grateful Dead focused on their performances, on developing the music, and their careers as Haight Ashbury phenomenon faded away like a rainbow after a hurricane. The music began to develop some entrancing qualities as they rehearsed day after day, working to create new songs and new recordings. They had a deep need to succeed. We all believed in the vitality of the band's music, and we felt the creative juice flow. Our fearless band of acid testers began improvising, creating new material, and co-creating in the moment. Taking psychedelics together for concerts, their music flowed into new and unpredictable places. Using the songs as platforms, patterns, and substructure, they realized they could just let go and play what was in the now, and then come back to the organized song. Elements of jazz, folk music, and rock and roll, and sometimes jagged, unplanned, exciting things fused and fragmented, flew apart, reformed into mysterious journeys. Technical problems, feedback, hums, random events, and cosmic interference were all part of the show and enhanced the playfulness and changed with each little musical landscape. Jerry said that each note had a little spirit, a little life in it. And because of their skill and all that endless rehearsal, they were able to make it sound good. The audience loved it. The audience was that other element, responding, filling the air with energy, calling out, leaping into ecstatic dance, reacting to each change in the music, in close communion and exchange of energy. Energy rolled around the concerts, spinning the audience into higher and higher states. Owsley Stanley took on a role as the band's patron early in 1966. He supported them through the end of the acid test in their early recording sessions. Determined and single-minded, I'm stepping out here. I want you to know this. Determined and single-minded, he pushed them to expand and bought all new stage equipment, guitars, instruments, and amplifiers. He traveled with the band, fanned the flames of their adventure, and by his very presence, confounded any attempt to participate in the conventional corporate music business. His will was a force to be reckoned with. He was opinionated, independent, stubborn, and righteous. He saw the future clearly. His dream was to be the sixth musician and be a limb of the creative force monster that was manifesting on stage. His vision of sound as architecture drove him to expend his capital building the new technology for onstage monitors, for so the musicians could hear each other on stage, mixing, and he built a whole new main PA, which I showed you a minute ago, that thing. Fade canceling microphones, and endless loops of new stuff clogged up the flow of the concerts when the gear didn't function. And the band suffered gut-wrenching delays and interruptions too frequently. There was much friction. But there was no stopping the creative flow. The music edged into the unseen worlds, and people changed their lives to go to Grateful Dead concerts. People joined up, went on tour, started to add up how many concerts they made it to. Unlike other performers, the Grateful Dead didn't repeat themselves. Each concert was very different, an experimental feeling is never the same, and that created interest and excitement in the audience. Focused on developing the musical rapport, we were all astonished and a bit dismayed at the ever-growing clan of enthusiasts. By 1972, all around the core, a large circle of support moved with us everywhere, carrying a new cultural consciousness and a fascination with all things psychedelic. an island was forming in the mainstream of American culture. Our messianic vision was fading and changing into a business entity, driven by the need for income to offset the expense of an ever-growing crew and family. Trucks were bought. Housing and the crew created the wall of sound to fill the bigger halls. As the challenges got bigger, the band had to increase their size. The Dead continued to play the college campuses, however, as the political storms of wars and assassinations swirled outside. The band always remained sympathetic, but deliberately apolitical. And they focused on their long experiential events, often playing for 6 hours in a night. Imagery of dancing, winking skeletons, red roses, and outrageous costumes enticed these new converts to events resembling a religious revival meeting. The band provided access to a magic bridge, leading to a gestalt of love and affirmation. And many stoned heads felt the first stirrings of religious feeling. Feedback between ecstatic audiences and the musicians gathered energy. The entrancement grew stronger, the events larger, as more energy pulsed through a long, slow gathering of momentum. Their talent grew for bringing a huge room full of people into the same psycho-spiritual space, bringing everybody in together. I was caught in that too, and supported it from my spot behind the amplifiers, projecting the energy, helping the room to flow. As an extended family, our support for the art grew to the point where it superseded everything else. We were locked in. We worked. It was all about the work. And now I look back and wonder why we were so intensely dialed in, so focused, because it was so compelling that what they co-created on stage with so many others just did not always work. And it would fall apart. And then the depression and anxiety kicked in. It kicked us into working harder the next time. Everything depended on that unifying force, it seemed. I remember one time the band played at the Stanford University in the mid-1980s during the worst of the Reagan years. When nothing else was happening, all festivals had shut down. There was nothing to go to. Every other festival event had been shut down. And here was a Grateful Dead show, outdoors, in the trees, with 15,000 people greeting each other, loving each other, recreating their community and creating this beautiful alternative community that's now cross-pollinating. And I'm really proud of all that. We made a place for everyone. Well, everyone to meet. Well, it was not exactly a safe place. It was attractive enough to generate the impulse to get there. And these slides that I've just been showing you are the envelopes that people sent in the lottery to get tickets to the shows during the 1980s. The better the envelope, the better your likelihood of getting the ticket from our in-house ticket office. And so people just made the most wonderful, wonderful collection. I'm so glad I photographed these before they all disappeared. Anyway, so the Grateful Dead show at Stanford was a real watershed for me because I suddenly saw it. I saw our island. I saw it in the midst of the police and the new college kids with their fresh minds and fresh faces. In astonishment, meeting this herd of committed deadheads there under the trees. So that place was attractive enough to generate the impulse to get there, and it gave a place for people to find each other and bond. And I hope that all those babies that were made there now know that this was a real community, as well as the biggest circus in the world for years and years and years. After Jerry's death in 1995, it has all sort of devolved. It began to let us all go and to remember what we were doing before we got engaged in this gigantic enterprise. I look back on that long, long period of effort. Our children were born amidst a multitude of adventures that superseded family vacations, adventures that the children don't remember. And what now? How to deal with the aftermath? The gigantic energy and goodwill thrown out by the concert cannot be remade. Even the best recordings are not going to recreate that communion. I know that our hearts were opened by the theaters. There is no way to close them anymore. Excuse me. We can't go back to society the way it was. We have changed. We are new people. We are old now. And in love and in gratitude and in kindness, that is the path. Community is a spirit, an effort, an art. We don't know when we are going to meet again. I look forward to that day very much. Thank you. Transporting people to the new place. He certainly did that for me.
I was curious about how you felt about the increased corporatization of the Grateful Dead, which really had become a money-making machine at the end. And that was very much a part of it, too. And it felt very different than what you were describing later on when everyone was kind of like a dollar sign in the audience. And it felt that any of that new expression and sharing... So on, the audience had its own separate thing, and the band had its separate thing, and everyone was separate. You felt the band didn't even like each other.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that the audience by that time was so damn sensitive that you pick up on all of the signals and fully understood. However, if you go out now and listen to some of the music they were doing in 1989 and 1990, it was brilliant. It was some of the best stuff they ever did. But you're correct. The corporate music business is a pitfall snake. It's an awful place to find yourself, and none of them were happy about it. And they really felt like they had lost their independence. And for free will maniacs like them to have to know where you're going to be on August 17th, and like 6 months in advance, you're going to be sweltering on the stage in Wisconsin. It's not that much fun anymore. And so.
You could see they weren't having fun.
But my hat's off to them for carrying it forth, even though it became something very different.
What would you say, looking back on the experiential difference of the Sandoz acid and the Osmi acid?
Oh, I think they were completely different. I'd be happy to talk about that. The Sandoz acid is only the Cadillac of drugs. was the Mercedes with two flat tires. That's a bumpy ride.
Parallels between your experiences then and the rave scene in the 90s?
Oh, very much so. In fact, some friends of mine and I went to a rave in the mid-90s, and we were the only people there with gray hair, and I just thought it was the greatest thing. It was just wonderful, and people were just dancing with the freeness of it, and I loved that. I don't know that all raves are that way, but I think it's a direct, we all have this need to move through space and time with our bodies freed of the usual constrictions of social grace, and boy, raves are great for that. And I didn't miss the band at all. That thing of not having a band to look at, and suddenly you're 360 degrees again. You're not in the audience situation. We sort of, I guess it was when concerts became the thing and events fell away, the promoters only wanted to put on concerts. They wanted everybody to sit in their seats. The stairwell faces forward, the dancing was not allowed, and the police were there to make sure that you didn't dance. They worked through all that stuff year after year after year and continued to put on the shows, but it was very, very difficult to give up the freedom and find yourself in a concert situation. Nobody really liked it, but the money was really good.
First of all, crazy respect for cooking for 9 men. Thank you so much for that. And I just wonder, in all of your experience, everything that Terry Eckert, you failed by, what you're for, and then you came to the end, which was this incredible heart opening, that's what it's for, and that we should all come to that place of recognizing that and all of our cultural communities coming together from that place. So what's one tool that you recommend we carry with us so that we don't stay in that place? Like, what's the point of flailing around if there was one thing that you could...
A tool.
An experience, a something.
Well, I think it's recognizing that everybody is the same and that all souls are the same weight. And nobody's bigger or smaller than anybody else, and that there's actually, in our new quantum universe, there's no distance between us. And I think the only tool you can really carry there is to recognize that that stranger is really you too.
How often do you think the members of the Grateful Dead were actually on LSD while they were playing music during the acid test and then in the following decade?
But the acid test always. In the following decade, probably for the first decade after that, pretty regularly. Not all the time, because they would do three or four shows a week, and you can't get away with that. But very often, and recreationally as well, outside of work. For them now that they're gone. Pretty much I'm a support crew for them. You know, that was plenty for me at the time. And now if I can help keep that, all those ideas flowing, I'm happy to do that.
Yes, Mountain Girls, pardon my English. I want to thank you for your tears and you showed us your feelings. And I think it's very strong feelings. And how maybe you can tell me how you make it a positive part of your life nowadays in this moment.
Well, after Jerry died, it was about 5 years before I could really listen to the music again, because it's maybe different. One of the things I wanted to do to get across in my speech was the emotional, the emotional baggage that came with being around that music all the time. We were so connected, it was so entrained to it. In other words, I hear it and my whole nervous system reacts instantly. I know instantly what it is. And I have a whole set of trained responses to it. And it's taken me this long to be able to talk about it openly. I don't know how to describe it other than to say it was a kind of enchantment, a modern enchantment, and possibly not safe to be like that. It was so, you know, it had all this amplification, but it also had this amazing liquid quality of being in the moment, the momentary change. Boy, it was very hard to break away from. I was a slave to that, an emotional slave, I think. So that's my confession. Yes.
You know, I went to shows a lot, and I know I would kind of bring my own piece.
Sure.
I used to call it Grateful Day teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have something would come up and it'd be like a song or a word or a phrase, and I would give you an answer to something I was chewing on. Mm-hmm. And I always sort of wondered, were the dead aware of that? I mean, were they aware that they were, I mean, I don't want to put a name on it, but there was this real synchronistic thing going on.
There was tremendous synchrony going on between the music and the audience. The audience was like the sounding board, the emotional sounding board. I mean, you can feel emotion from people without even having to look at them. You know, it interacts, and this is all real stuff. We don't really know how in the quantum universe emotion exists, but it's a palpable force. And so when they would go up on stage, and the audience would leap up, you know, they could feel that as a rush of energy. That's fairly addictive, I do believe.
Yes.
But it wasn't, luckily it wasn't directed at me, but I could feel it anyway. It was a lot to deal with, and sometimes it was completely overwhelming. But they very consciously created those songs to harmonize with that emotional state in the audience, and then to reinforce it and
And when they felt the reinforcement coming from the audience, they knew they were on the right track. And so they would proceed in that direction. That was the signal. And as they changed their musical style from R&B, from rhythm and blues, when they were trying to sound like the Rolling Stones, at the beginning, and then it went off into this other space of improvisation, and these songs that they wrote to have emotional content, it turned into this whole other thing. And yet they would always come back to the celebration songs. They would come back to those songs that get everybody up dancing. But there was a tremendous consciousness of that emotional force in the room.
As somebody who currently lives in Haight-Ashbury, you know, I still find it to be a really enchanting place. But I'm curious, what contemporary cultural movements do you see best continuing on the spirit of the pranksters today?
Hard to say. I can see little sporadic bits of pranksterdom here and there. I'm really not sure. You know, I think the whole internet thing has got a pranksterish element about it. It's pretty good. You know. I don't really know where. I have to assume it's youthful enthusiasm will always resurgent. There will always be resurgent. Each group of young people that find each other and create events that they reciprocally enjoy each other's company. They all are going to have a little spirit of pranksterism about them, and I think that it's largely a humor-based philosophy.
Where did the Mountain Girl handle come from?
Well, when I first encountered these guys back in whenever it was, 64, 65, everybody took a name. But you didn't invent it yourself. Somebody had to give it to you. And they asked me where I lived, and I just pointed up, and I said, well, I live up there on top of that mountain, because I had a little cabin up on top of the mountain. I said, oh, well, you must be Mountain Girl. And I'm like, oh, no. I've never been able to get rid of it. And it's okay now. But one of the characters gave me that name that first day I was there.
Do you think Burning Man carries on that spirit a little bit?
I love Burning Man, and I go every year. I think Burning Man is one of the most outstanding events ever. It does have some pranksterish energy, but it also has such intense organization about it. But there's a lot of trust in play at Burning Man. People trust. They have to trust each other. And so I think most people that go to Burning Man are not new to psychedelics. They're already pretty seasoned heads who know how to survive in that environment, because it's not an easy environment. At least I would hope so. But I think that the most hopeful and cheerful, like for me, I got very excited when I went to Burning Man for the first time. Thrilled. And I recommend it highly.
How interesting your comment about the liquid quality of time, and I'm thinking about this the nature of experience and the fact that this is we're talking about an experience of a long time ago. And I keep thinking, what happened to all that film? And how do you manage the kind of documentation process at the time of happening to afterwards?
Well, what we used to do is get the film developed and then show it at the next party. You know, with often that, you know, there would be three or four parties in between when the film would come back from the lab. The film was really slow and it was really expensive to get it processed. So with the LSD and the parties, and we kind of got lost out of their cans, and the leader that said what it was fall off, and you know, so it's a cataloging problem. A lot of that film is lodged, I believe, at the LA Film Archive right now, mostly being transferred to digital format. But it's really jumbled. We cut up. We used to cut it into little bits and make little special movies. I used to cut triple screen pieces that would show on three screens at once. That was a lot of fun. And but you know, it had globs of tape all over it, and it just, you know, it's going to take a lot of effort. And who's got the time? By the time I caught up with these guys in 1964, there was already 75 hours of film in cans. And by the time we quit, that was triple. So it's just too much for anybody to deal with, really. It's pretty huge. And a lot of it is not very well photographed. So it's going to require a team of people with a lot of patience to sort it all out. I don't know if that'll ever happen. I don't know if it's even really important. I'm not sure. Back there.
It's such a monopoly of different drugs, and the quality of the LSD and different things has really suffered over the years. Do you think that's changed the vibe of the whole sort of music thing?
I don't know. I sort of don't go out much. I live on a little sheep ranch in Oregon. Recently, however, in the last couple of years, there's definitely been a better quality product. But I really don't know the ins and outs of that. It may be, I mean, obviously the landscape has grown a lot larger when it comes to new varieties. But most of them I have not experienced myself. Good question. Matthew?
Is there anything you'd like to share about Jerry as you knew him? Maybe some of his more personal qualities.
Just that he was a workaholic, and you know, he wasn't happy if he didn't have a show within the next 24 hours or someplace to go play. He always felt like if he stopped playing for 48 hours, he would lose his skill. He would lose his ability to play. So he was very driven. He was driven to be the very best. That was what he wanted to be. And I don't think that they had the idea that they would do this kind of music. I mean, who would ever know how to develop this kind of music? It can only develop under sort of extraordinary circumstances, and they, you know, somehow the cosmic forces aligned to create this cauldron, this experimental cauldron of music. And when I call it the music monster, it really was a monster because it had so much of a life of its own. And Jerry didn't claim that those very experiential parts of the music were anything that he had authored. As far as he was concerned, it just came in from the noosphere. And we had endless discussions, philosophical discussions about where the music was coming from. And we were like, no, it was just coming when you set the stage up right, and everybody could hear each other, and the microphones were good. This is what happened with these people. And the experience became one that drew everybody in.
You have some favorite songs?
Ooh, yeah, I have a lot of favorite songs. I really wanted to, and I just didn't get around to it. I had so much trouble with my slideshow because I'd never done anything like this before. And I was pulling material from everywhere, and I wanted to pull in the lyrics to Addicts Online because that's probably my favorite song. And I think it fits very well with this conference. And I wanted to have that, but it just didn't happen. That one to me is the one that really kind of sums it up.
Did you ever experience downside of your drug use?
Oh, you bet. The next morning, you know, always really tired. I mean, and living on a bus is just like there really isn't any place to rest. You're sort of resting, standing up a lot of the time, or you know, curled up on a pillow somewhere like a cat. But I think the worst downside for me was as far as drugs were concerned, was anything that had any speed in it at all. It was just so difficult to deal with, and you know, a couple of days of that, and you'll ruin your life. Because then everything just it turns into something dark and miserable, and that is continuously devolving rather than evolving, and it's a very strange thing that happens, you can take all the brightest and loveliest things in the world and turn them dark and awful in a few hours. So I think avoidance is a good piece of the puzzle for people who want to live a happy life. Avoid many things. Well, I think we've run out of time pretty thoroughly, and it's lunch, and maybe you want some.
You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I know that there are a few of our fellow saloners who were actually living in San Francisco during the times Mountain Girl just described, and so this should really bring back some interesting memories. I was about to say fond memories, but recently I saw the film Aquarius Rising, which is a documentary that was shot during the time Mountain Girl just described. And from the looks of it, well, all I can say is that it wasn't as romantic as it may seem right now. In fact, at times it seemed as if those hippies had to struggle just to survive. And the never-ending series of adventures that Mountain Girl lived through, even before she became the den mother to the Grateful Dead, well, that's a path that not many people could handle. It was interesting, I thought, that she ended with a warning about speed. You know, let's face it, Mountain Girl has survived more of a drug scene than any of us will ever get close to, and yet here she is smiling, laughing, and still exuding joy and caution about safety wherever she goes. As we just heard, by 1967, when Tim Leary says the 60s really began, Carolyn Garcia had already lived through the Merry Prankster experience, which is something that many people also associate with the 60s. And by the time she moved in with Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead, she'd already lived a more legendary life than most of us can even dream of. And then came the years with the Dead. What a truly amazing and unique woman she is. I'm sure that 1,000 years or so from now, she'll most likely be worshipped as the goddess of the mountains or something like that. I'm still blown away by the compassion in her voice just now as she recalled the sad faces of all the young people who descended on the hate during the summer of 1967. And what touches me so much about her empathy for those young people is that here she was, only 20 years old or so, a single mom, and yet it was still the young people who she so wanted to help during that summer of love. She's definitely a bodhisattva in my book. And as for the World Psychedelic Conference itself, I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it in the weeks ahead. And you'll certainly be able to hear many of the talks, if not all of the English talks, over on Psychonautica from Max Freakout. But here are a couple thoughts about it from Otto Vidal, who recorded this talk for us. He says, "As a conclusion about the conference, what I've said 2 days after the event and to what I stick today is that something was missing. First of all, I've been deeply troubled by lack of drinkable water for free, not to mention really expensive meals. I suppose for Swiss people, those were not expensive at all, but that's just it. Switzerland is the most expensive country I've been to, and food and drinks at the conference should have been a lot cheaper. But that's my opinion. It has nothing to do with the speakers nor the whole format, but still a pain in the ass when one spends 12 hours listening. Translation was extra and came with a price. Half of the conference has been done in German, which I don't understand. This way I missed Christian Rasch, who I'd love to hear, and Ralph Metzner, who also did his speeches in German. Last thing is that I had this slight hope that there would be some powerful ideas presented by ingenious pioneers of the psychedelic movement. And, well, none of those I've heard. Nothing to really think about in the end, no far-fetched suggestions, stories, etc. The whole conference, besides things I've mentioned, was great, don't get me wrong. The atmosphere was awesome, but still not magical. I don't know, or maybe I'm just a die-hard fan of Terence's talks." Well, Otto Vidal, I know what you're saying. And it's too bad that you didn't get to hear Christian Rasch speak. He's one of my all-time favorite presenters at conferences like this. I'll have to see if I can dig out some more of the old tapes of him in Palenque for us here in the salon someday. But in any event, thanks again for making these recordings, particularly this one of Mountain Girl, as it definitely ties up a few of the loose ends in the little history of the 60s that we've been playing around with here in the salon. And I'd like to go on a bit longer, but if I'm going to get this podcast out before we leave on our little trip, I'm going to have to bring this to a close for now. And as always, I want to close by saying that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, or you can also find the program notes for these podcasts, and that's at psychedelicsalon.org. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.